It is indeed a great pleasure to hear today from Dr. Edward Friedman, a renowned expert on Cervantes and a professor of Spanish and comparative literature at Vanderbilt University. Dr. Friedman received a BA from the University of Virginia and an MA and PhD degree from Johns Hopkins University. He's taught at Kalamazoo College, Arizona State University, Indiana University, and was a visiting professor at the University of Lisbon in Portugal. Dr. Friedman has published books that focus on Cervantes, the picaresque novel, Spanish drama of the 16th and 17th centuries, and he served as the editor of three journals and is currently as the editor of the Bulletin of the Comediantes, devoted to Renaissance and Baroque theater in Spain and in colonial Latin American theater. He's the author of two textbooks and more than 300 articles and reviews, and has edited several collections of essays. He's held elected positions in professional organizations and is the immediate past president of the Cervantes Society of America. He's the recipient of grants from the National Endowment for the Humanities, the National Humanities Center, and the Fulbright Program. And his latest research project centers on Don Quixote, and he has just completed a book-length manuscript entitled Cervantes in the Middle, which looks at the experimental Spanish novels from the mid-16th century to the early 20th century. Dr. Friedman and his wife live in Nashville, Tennessee. Let's now give Dr. Edward Friedman a warm welcome to Brigham Young University.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much, Vice President Tanner. My history with Brigham Young University goes back a number of years, from my time at Arizona State University, where the Rocky Mountain location brought me into contact with colleagues and students from BYU, and on several occasions gave me the chance to visit the university. I recall noting BYU's being at the forefront of developing technologies, and I can remember seeing the Missionary Training Center for the first time. What has been a constant of my stays on campus has been the warmth of students, faculty, and administrators, and my admiration for the academic programs, for the interest in international culture. It was not surprising to me that the Department of Spanish and Portuguese planned a magnificent conference to celebrate the 400th anniversary of the publication of Part One of Don Quixote, and I feel privileged to have had the chance to participate in the conference. I can't tell you how honored I am to have been invited to speak here today, and I hope to spark your interest in things quixotic. I would like to thank President Cecil O. Samuelson and the University Forum Committee, Dean John Rosenberg, Professor Alvin Sherman, and the members of the Department of Spanish and Portuguese for the kind invitation and for the regal treatment that they have given me. My thanks also to the groups on campus who have facilitated my stay in Provo, to Mr. Michael Hunter of BYU Television for his technical advice and support. I would like to thank old friends for standing behind me and new friends for their graciousness. And last but hardly least, I would like to thank each of you for being here or for being within hearing range. The world is currently celebrating the 400th anniversary of the publication of Part One of Don Quixote by the Spanish writer Miguel de Cervantes, who lived from 1547 to 1616. Cervantes was a contemporary of Shakespeare, and for many, his influence on the novel was as profound as that of Shakespeare on the theater. As in the case of numerous people who accomplished great things, perhaps the majority of such people, Cervantes' biography is not an unqualified success story. Miguel de Cervantes Saavedra was born in the university city of Alcalá de Henares, near Madrid, the son of an itinerant surgeon, a profession that did not enjoy the prestige that it does today. We know little of the author's early life. It seems likely that he studied in Madrid under the guidance of the educator Juan López de Hoyos, a man of humanist leanings. Fate takes him to Italy. It is conjectured that he left Spain to avoid arrest after injuring another young man in a fight. Records show that a Miguel de Cervantes was involved in the row, but we cannot be sure that the culprit was our Miguel de Cervantes. The crucial fact here is that by 1570, Cervantes had enlisted as a soldier in the Christian struggle against Islam, and in the following year he took part in the much-celebrated Battle of Lepanto, in which the combined papal, Venetian, Genoese, and Spanish fleets defeated rival Turkish forces. Cervantes was extremely proud to have participated in this victory. He was gravely wounded in the battle. He recovered but lost the use of his left hand. His valor was recognized, and he departed on a galley headed for Spain with letters of recommendation that seemed almost guaranteed to secure him a prominent position in the military service. En route to Spain, however, his ship was overtaken by pirates who transported their prisoners to Algiers, where Cervantes spent 5 years from 1575 to 1580 in captivity before being ransomed and allowed to return to his homeland. When his long ordeal was over, another was waiting for him. His heroism yielded little fruit, and although he held a number of minor posts, he was never a successful professional. Cervantes published his first novel in 1585, the pastoral romance Galatea, in a tradition that featured shepherds, their loves, high-flown language, idealized settings, and very few sheep in major roles. During this early period, he wrote incidental poetry, and if we are to take him at his word, 20 or 30 plays, of which only two have been conserved. Cervantes married a woman 19 years his junior, and from all accounts, their marriage was not a happy one. They often lived apart. The commissions that he was able to obtain took him to southern Spain as a collector of grain for the crown. These were hard economic times, and he found himself in an extremely difficult situation. Attempting to carry out his task, he got into trouble with the church and may have served time in prison. He spent some years in Seville, a picturesque and lively city in southern Spain that was home to artists, wealthy patrons, and rogues of many stripes. He probably wrote most of Don Quixote in Esquivias, his wife's village, and in Madrid, a hub of cultural activity, with protagonists that included the prolific and hugely popular playwright and poet Lope de Vega and others. Cervantes sold the book, and lamentably the Spanish copyright, to the man who had published Galatea. Don Quixote was an immediate bestseller, and it brought the author fame, if not fortune, at the advanced age of 58. In the last 10 years of his life, Cervantes would publish his collection of 12 short novels, the exemplary novellas, as well as 8 plays and 8 dramatic interludes, which, to his dismay, had never been performed on stage, together with the second part of Don Quixote, which appeared in 1615, and which we generally consider with its predecessor to form one novel. The work that Cervantes judged to be his masterpiece, an epic in prose of Byzantine proportions called The Trials of Persiles and Sigismunda, was published posthumously in 1617. That book, while highly respected, though now only read by students of Cervantes, was not to be his claim to fame. It is Don Quixote that makes Cervantes immortal. One should bear in mind that Don Quixote enters the literary domain at a time in which the novel was an experimental form, inventing itself as it went along, one might say. What is Don Quixote about? The main character is a lesser nobleman from a village in the La Mancha region of central Spain, who out of boredom and a feeling of isolation begins to read voraciously. His books of choice are the romances of chivalry, a genre that portrays knights errant who serve beautiful ladies and who enter into combat with and conquer all manner of foes through spectacular feats of skill and valor. The result of this obsessive reading is madness. The gentleman's brain dries up, and he refashions himself as a knight with a new name, Don Quixote, and a steed, makeshift armor, a lady to honor through his victories, and an admirable mission to redress all manners of wrongs and to place himself in harm's way for the betterment of humanity and with an eye on eternal fame and glory. He chooses as his love object a woman he names Dulcinea del Toboso, whose model is Aldonza Lorenzo, a farm girl from a neighboring village who is anything but ethereal. The Dulcinea-Aldonza dichotomy illustrates the contrast between idealism and stark reality, which informs the knight's quest and the novel in general. Don Quixote is an anachronism. He seeks to insert himself into an earlier era, as depicted not in history but in literature, when the real world has moved from a golden age to an age of iron. And as he sets forth with enormous faith in his enterprise, he expects those around him to accommodate the chivalric vision. Don Quixote is a prime example of what scholars call meta-fiction, an imaginative work that is conscious of its identity as literature, its literariness. The reader deals not only with a finished product, a plot, and a storyline, but also follows the process of composition. In the prologue to Part 1, the fictionalized author finds himself with a manuscript ready to submit to a publisher, but he fears writing a prologue, which by convention includes quotations from learned sources. A friend appears and advises him to make up his own text, to fill in the space in any way that he chooses, and the discussion between the two does exactly that. As we enter Chapter 1, we encounter a narrator who does not seem to have a firm grasp on the relevant data. He does not name the village in La Mancha or even the gentleman who becomes Don Quixote. Several options are given, none of them correct, and he is vague about details. He alleges to strive for historical precision, but he and his informants cannot supply all the facts of what is purportedly the true history of Don Quixote. The Spanish word historia is perfect here because it means story and history. In the first few pages of the narrative, Cervantes has introduced fundamental questions about truth, perspective, objectivity, and the perception of reality, with large doses of humor and irony. The narrator talks about various versions of the story or history, and barely having commenced his journey and before his first adventure on the road, Don Quixote worries about the accuracy of the chronicle that will record his exploits, and he has good reason for concern. Don Quixote is injured during one of his initial adventures and is brought home to recover. There, his niece, housekeeper, and friends, the village priest and the barber, review the books in his library and burn those that they consider offensive in an allegory of the Spanish Inquisition. The romances of chivalry suffer the gravest fate. It is interesting to note that Cervantes' Galatea figures among the books under scrutiny. When Don Quixote secretly departs on his second sally, he takes with him a local peasant named Sancho Panza as his squire. It is as if Cervantes realized that the narrative had room for expansion, that rather than a novella, he could go farther with his original satirical concept, and Sancho Panza gives Don Quixote a dialogue partner, a foil, and an interpreter of reality. He provides comic relief through his conduct, his mounting frustration, and his language. He also does something else that proves to be crucial. The knight and the squire have a special dynamics. They grow on and influence each other. The Spanish scholar Salvador de Madariaga refers to this interdependence as the quixotification of Sancho and the sanchification of Don Quixote. There is a subtle psychology at work within the broad strokes of comedy. Don Quixote has invented chivalric roles for the two of them, but the real people behind the masks show through in what has been called the great theater of the world. At the end of Chapter 8, the chapter in which Don Quixote famously attacks a windmill, the knight is engaged in battle with a human foe. When the narrator confesses to readers that he has run out of material, he has no more information to convey. In the next chapter, at a marketplace in the city of Toledo, he chances upon a manuscript written in Arabic that he has to have translated, and he realizes that this is the story of Don Quixote, beginning where the earlier narration had left off, with the knight in mid-battle. The author of the manuscript is an Arab historian by the name of Cide Hamete Benengeli. The interruption not only makes us conscious of the writing process, but it places a stumbling block in the way of history and truth. The Muslims were the enemies of Catholic Spain, and they were associated by the Christians with lying. That an Arab historian should chronicle the true history of Don Quixote is certainly designed to shake the foundations of reliability and the sanctity of the written word. Cervantes recognizes from the prologue onward that this was a time in which authority was being challenged on multiple levels, to an extent because it was a period of discovery, of a new world, a new science, and with the printing press, a new means of communication of ideas. On one plane, Don Quixote is an anachronism. On another, he is a symbol of the developing print culture, while the illiterate Sancho Panza stands for the oral tradition of the past. Cervantes is throwing out a mixed bag of tricks for the reader, And the complexity escalates as the narrative moves forward. Narrators multiply exponentially. At about the middle of part one, the chivalric adventures turn into what might be classified as adventures in storytelling. And there are two lengthy interpolated tales, one based on an Italian novella and read aloud from a manuscript, and the other narrated by a captive who has just escaped from an Algerian prison. There's a beautiful moment in the text in which Sancho Panza tells a poor victim of Don Quixote's zeal, "If anyone should inquire as to who put you in such a state, you may reply that it was Don Quixote de la Mancha, the Knight of the Sad Countenance." Don Quixote asks Sancho what inspired him to utter that statement, and the squire answers that his master, whether from fatigue or the loss of several teeth in battle, had an extremely sorrowful look. Don Quixote disagrees. "That is not the reason. The wise man who has been entrusted with the task of writing the history of my deeds must have deemed it fitting for me to take some appellation, as did the knights of old. One was the knight of the burning sword, another the knight of the unicorn, and so forth." Don Quixote here is exalting the role of the author, who puts words into characters' mouths. The protagonist's acknowledgement of narrative ventriloquism is a metafictional device that underscores the capacity of the creative imagination, and obviously of the creator himself. Paradoxically and brilliantly, Cervantes steps back to give voice to a variety of narrators, but he keeps the art of writing, and thus the writer, at the center of his project. The author, the core of narrators, and the reader hold their own with Don Quixote in the scheme of things. In addition to the emphasis on reading and writing, Cervantes focuses on criticism, as for example in the inspection of books in Don Quixote's library, and also in two dialogues toward the end of part one, in which characters debate the merits of the romances of chivalry and the status of the theater in Spain. The commentary on the theater is a sharp critique of the dramatic formula popularized by Lope de Vega. The village priest and a canon from Toledo note that Lope ignores the classical or neoclassical unities of time and place. We can see a baby in Act One grown into a bearded old man in Act Three, and each act can take place on a different continent. The names of the playwrights who respect dramatic protocol are bandied about, including that of Cervantes. It must be recalled that Cervantes has had high dramatic aspirations and little or no success on the stage. Sour grapes seem to enter the frame in this instance. Cervantes has the opportunity to vent his anger, but he will pay a price for this mocking of the competition. In the fall of 1614, as Cervantes presumably was toiling to finish the second part of Don Quixote, there appeared a sequel written by someone else, under the pseudonym of Alonso Fernández de Avellaneda, whose identity remains unknown. One can only imagine the frustration that Cervantes would have felt over the infringement of his intellectual property. The success of Don Quixote Part I had finally brought him celebrity, and this literary adversary threatened the legitimate second part. To make matters worse, Avellaneda compromised the characters of Don Quixote and Sancho and hurled insults at Cervantes. It seems likely that the pseudonymous author was a friend and advocate of Lope de Vega, and that he sought retribution for Cervantes' condemnation of Lope's dramaturgy. This thorn in the side of Cervantes turned out to be, ironically, a godsend for the real second part, which was published the following year. Many scholars deduce that Cervantes was well into the writing of Part II when the unauthorized sequel came out, probably having completed well over 50 of the 74 chapters, and that he did not undertake major revisions of those chapters. Thus, there was a set direction to the narrative. An identifying thread to the 1615 Quixote is a criticism of the 1605 novel. One character reports to Don Quixote on how readers have responded to the book and what they have regarded as its strengths and weaknesses. Among the flaws are the intercalated stories, which intrude on the main plot. At one point, Don Quixote asks, in the sequel, if a sequel has been planned. A consequence of the circulation of the book is that several key characters of Part II have read Part I. They know Don Quixote before they meet him, and they chart adventures before he can act. They render him passive as they increasingly control the events. To an extent, Don Quixote needs to be energized, revitalized, and the Avellaneda sequel does precisely that. It compels him and Cervantes to want to fight back and to prove his superiority. Cervantes incorporates into the narrative several scenes aimed at doing just that. In chapter 59 of part 2, Don Quixote is at an inn where he overhears two gentlemen conversing about the Avellaneda sequel, and they give him a copy to peruse. When he visits Barcelona, he sees the book in a printing establishment. In chapter 72, at another inn, he meets Don Alvaro Tarfe, a character from the false continuation, who certifies before a notary that the genuine Don Quixote is the one who stands before him. What for me is the most intriguing thing about the impact of the Avellaneda sequel on Cervantes' part two is the manner in which the invasive text blends into the playful and cautionary treatment of history. Cervantes fabricates the Arab chronicler of the true history when truthfulness and neutrality are dubious. Avellaneda promotes a reevaluation of the strategy, for now, Cide Hamete Benengeli's version, seen in opposition to the spurious continuation, definitively becomes the true history. His false alter ego spurs Don Quixote into action. The same thing happens to Cervantes. He must rethink his motives and reevaluate his blueprint for the novel. Among other things, he must align himself with the Arab historian against their shared enemy. He can offer testaments to the preeminence of his Don Quixote, yet one might suppose that he still has to adjust the ending to the altered circumstances. The prologue to Part 2, read first but written last, is far removed from that of Part 1. The fictionalized Cervantes, launching an intricate literary game, cedes to an offended historical Cervantes, who to a degree is fighting for his honor. The second prologue reveals Don Quixote's fate to the reader. At the novel's conclusion, and unlike the chivalric heroes who are succeeded by their sons and grandsons, he will be dead and buried in order to ward off subsequent sequels. Nonetheless, at the end of the narrative, Cervantes has his protagonist go through a process of disillusionment, a release from his madness, in order to reject knight-errantry and his past fantasies. The double death of Don Quixote keeps the ending open and fosters debate on analysis and interpretation. Cervantes, incited by Avellaneda, shows the wide range of conventions and the flexibility available to the novelist. Moreover, he refuses to let readers be idle as he involves them in the plot and messages of the novel. In Don Quixote, Cervantes breaks away from certain types of literary idealism, such as the romances of chivalry, which present lofty views of humanity and reality. Don Quixote is metafictional, exposing its seams as a literary artifact, but at the same time, it is realistic, looking at society, social institutions, and human nature, not from above, but at ground level. The rigid class system, religious discrimination, extremes of honor, gender inequities, and censorship are among the topics that make their way into the novel. One can learn much about the mindset of late 16th and early 17th century Spain, as well as about universal values from Don Quixote. Cervantes' style of realism differs from that of the succeeding centuries, in the novels of Daniel Defoe, Charles Dickens, or Jane Austen, for example, because the later writers invite the reader to accept the illusion of reality, while Cervantes blatantly exhibits his technique and the tools of his trade. He gives us a story and shows us how a novel is constructed, making us conscious of the heavy burden placed on the author. Cervantes wrote no treatises or theories of the novel. His theory is built into and must be extracted from his narrative practice. I believe that Cervantes depends heavily on a notion of realism, but that he does not understand realism to stem from the direct imitation of reality. His means of access to reality is through the recourses of literature. He flaunts those recourses unapologetically in order to get us to think about how we observe and reflect on books and on the universe. There is a correspondence between how, as readers, we try to make sense of verbal signs and how, as citizens of the world, we try to make sense of the signs that surround us. We perceive reality not by confronting it face on, but from a distance, and metafiction serves as a vehicle for entertainment and comprehension. Literature is not so much a mirror to reality as a conduit. For Cervantes, it would seem, books neither replicate nor advise an escape from reality, but serve as a means by which we can come to appreciate the beauty and the mystery of words and to examine and accept the relative over the absolute. Cervantes thus has a sweeping agenda from slapstick to philosophy, theology, politics, and literary theory. His funny book is rich in madcap antics and absurd incidents. The mere idea of pursuing a knightly quest is ludicrous. Don Quixote is out of place in what were then modern times. That is, he is out of touch with reality, blinded by idealism, and committed to forcing his outmoded principles onto others. We laugh at his earnest faith in the goodness of his fellow men and women, and his faith in his ability to fight corruption, because his vision is as simplistic as it is commendable. One might argue that life takes place in the gray areas and that Don Quixote can only see matters as black and white. He is completely lacking in cynicism in a cynical world, a world in which idealism has become unfashionable. On first glance, his frame of reference would appear to be the Golden Age, the age of chivalry, which really did exist as a social phenomenon. But it is not chivalry, but chivalric romance that guides Don Quixote. He follows books to the letter. He is a literalist, and the romance has become his Bible. Yet in the Spain of the day, the books of chivalry were by no means holy books. In the mid-16th century, the Council of Trent sought to fight the tide of Protestantism in another religious conflict by promoting Catholicism in every way possible. Escape fiction did not qualify as didactic or instructional literature, and it was frowned upon by church and state. Cervantes brings that dispute into Don Quixote, where the knight defends the books of chivalry up to the last chapter, when we can say that he comes back to reality. So Don Quixote is a book full of ideas and a book about books. It explores questions of authority, behavior, economics, technology, and the power and limits of language. Don Quixote, the character, is in certain respects a stick figure, a hollow man, bound as he is to literature, a literary invention who models himself on fictional beings. And yet he is multifaceted, like the book into which he is inscribed. Some critics treat his madness as satirical, others as symbolic, and still others as pathological. He is on one level the epitome of unreality, with only negligible ties to flesh and blood people. By delving ever more deeply into the literary realm, Cervantes seems to be detaching his protagonist from the real world. But Don Quixote can only foist his fictions on non-believers. Literary tradition stands on one end and society on the other, with Don Quixote positioned squarely and ingeniously in the middle. It is easy to laugh at him, but it is hard not to feel something for him, as if he were a human being. The magic of the novel is that it unites reality and fiction by refusing to see them as mutually exclusive. Despite the fact that he is a resoundingly fictional character who emulates other fictional characters, and that he tunes out the real world of the novel to put himself in the fantasy world of chivalry, Don Quixote manages to win the reader's sympathy. He is a rare combination, an art object, and something on the order of a living, breathing subject. We laugh at him, but we may be inclined to feel for him as well, and to suffer a bit when he suffers. Cervantes creates both an ironic distance encompassing satire and literary self-reference and a suspension of disbelief that is associated with empathy. Why do we as readers care about Don Quixote? I would submit that it is because he has a firm, if misplaced, conviction for what he is doing, and because we somehow relate to his physical pain and discomfort on the road and to his mocking by other characters who do not share his sincerity or his passion. In other words, we care about Don Quixote because behind all the literary trappings and the authorial interventions, he has a heart. When the knight first sets out on the road, he thinks of his reputation, but also of addressing grievances, shielding the innocent from harm, eliminating abuses, and protecting the defenseless. No sooner does he think these thoughts than he comes across a young shepherd, Andres, being beaten by his master. Don Quixote forces the cruel man, for him a fellow knight, to stop and extracts a promise from him that he will never again flog the boy. Andres warns him that the whipping will continue as soon as he is gone, but Don Quixote professes faith in the man's word. I have only to command and he will respect me and do my behest. His faith is unfounded, and Andres returns later in the novel to inform Don Quixote that he was flogged even more mercilessly afterwards. But his idealism, trust, and insistence on justice may strike the reader as exemplary. When Don Quixote meets a group of prisoners headed for the galleys, he is dismayed that they are being denied their freedom. He liberates them from their guards and asks them in return to pay homage to the Lady Dulcinea. They refuse and end by stoning him. Again, his good intentions and integrity betray him, because he can think only in absolutes. Yet his unquestionable decency shines through. When pushed to discuss the origins of Dulcinea del Toboso, Don Quixote asserts that everything is as I see it, neither more nor less. And in my imagination, I portray her as I wish her to be in both beauty and quality. Helen does not rival her, nor does Lucretia, nor any other celebrated woman of antiquity, whether Greek, barbarian, or Latin. He is lost in thought like a distracted intellectual, but his thoughts are pure and honest. His obsessions put him and others in danger, but there is always an underlying kindness or laudable purpose at the base of his actions. When late in the novel, Sancho Panza is commanded to receive over 3,000 lashes in order to save Dulcinea, Don Quixote is insistent that he comply, but when push comes to shove, he cannot bear to see his squire endure corporal punishment, and he comes up with an alternate remedy. As fixated and foolish and subjugated to the literary past as he may be, Don Quixote is what is called in Yiddish a mensch, a decent and upright man. On first learning that the chronicle of his chivalric feats has been published, Don Quixote asked the man who brought him the news about its reception. The response is that children thumb through it, young people read it, grown men understand it, and old men praise it. The implication is that not only is the book a resounding popular and critical success, but that it means different things to different readers, whose participation in the narrative gives them credit and responsibility. They are students and arbiters of the text, cast members and reviewers. They may note that if the cluster of narrators are surrogates for Cervantes, the historical author, then Don Quixote, the errant reader and madman, stands for all readers. Cervantes expands the frame of narrative fiction, and in this regard, Don Quixote often has been compared with the painting Las Meninas, or The Ladies-in-Waiting, by his near contemporary Diego Velázquez. Velázquez places the Princess Margarita and her retinue as the key focus of the portrait, with the artist at work on an unseen canvas on one side and the King and Queen of Spain reflected in a mirror in the spatial center. The monarchs stand outside the frame, observing as they are being observed in a painting that highlights the spectator or consumer of art. Velázquez brings in historical figures, but he also includes other paintings on the wall, and the king and queen in the mirror and the man in the open doorway look much like framed pictures. The inclusion of the artist elevates the creator and the act of creation, and as in the case of Don Quixote, process and product are intertwined. Whereas Velázquez encourages us to intensify our approach to viewing art and life, Cervantes magnifies the scope of the reading experience. Both accentuate what Stephen Sondheim has labeled the art of making art. To repeat then, what is Don Quixote about? Cervantes puts tremendous energy into the composition of the novel, but he wisely encodes or over-encodes the narrative, leaving the reader to determine its ultimate message and to distinguish between what is straightforward and what is ironic, what is conservative and what is unorthodox, what is serious and what is comic. Don Quixote fictionalizes history and historicizes literature. Truth, perception, and forms of expression are at its core. Cervantes reacts against idealistic literature by devising a protagonist seeped in idealism, ridiculed and trounced upon, yet in many instances discernibly superior to his detractors. Realism here is calculatedly ambiguous and paired with commentary on reading and writing. Metafiction lies at the heart of Don Quixote alongside a character with a heart, capable of amusing and moving readers and keeping them guessing. This is no small achievement. That is why we continue to discuss Don Quixote, to explicate it, and I hope that this will be the case for those of you who have not done so, to read it. Thank you very much.